Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Polly Staple, Frieze Projects and Talks Curator. I'm honoured to introduce Professor Thomas Crowe, who will be giving today's keynote lecture. Professor Crowe is Director of the Getty Research Institute, Professor of Art History at the University of South California, Los Angeles, and a contributing editor of Art Forum magazine. The former Robert Lehman Professor of Art History at Yale University, he has authored two influential studies of the 18th century, French painting, painters, and public life in France. Sorry, the light's a bit. And Emulation, the Art of Revolutionary France. Subsequent publications, including The Rise of the 60s, American and European Art in the Era of Dissent, and the collection of essays, Modern Art in the Common Culture, examine art in the late 20th century, while his book, The Intelligence of Art, analyzes specific moments across the history of art. Crowe's most recent texts focus on the works of individual artists, including Gordon Matta Clark, Robert Smithson, and the combines of Robert Rauschenberg. Professor Crowe is internationally recognized as one of the most influential art historians working today, whose original thinking and fresh insights have invigorated both the field of art history and contemporary art criticism. Crowe adheres to a structuralist principle, threading capitalism, iconoclasm, elite and vernacular culture in a symbiotic relationship, while focusing on the socioeconomic drive of historical circumstance and cultural change. Professor Crowe's analysis are all the more pertinent in the light of today's discussion of art and change. The discussion of the relationship between thought and commerce is particularly relevant to an art fair context. Today, Professor Crowe will be proposing, that the contemporary hyper-expansion of spaces for art will decisively alter the character of the art designed to fill them. This lecture will consider the ways in which institutional critique in art practice since the 1960s has laid the ground for a Baroque efflorescence of art's apparatus of display. Professor Crowe.
Well, thank you very much, Polly, and I really hope I can do all that you claimed on my behalf. Is it audible to everyone in the back?
Yes.
Good. And I want to thank Frieze for the invitation and Polly for all her help in getting me here, and all of you for coming. It's a whole different setting for doing a talk like this, but I think the content of it will... make you see that it's probably the right place to do it, or the right place to try it out for the first time at any rate. The light's a little dodgy here, so I have to use my specs to see what I've written. To talk about change, it seems to me, has to mean more than just observing that some change has taken place or trying to measure it. I think it also has to mean more than looking for causes in forces external to the system of art making and distribution, like too much free-floating money entering the market, which seems to be the favored explanation of the moment. I think what we've been missing is a model for how the art system operates, such that all of its participants are given equivalent weight in the way that we describe the system. And I think the currency that links all those participants, let's hypothesize at any rate, is less money than it is attention, recognition, and validation. Validation of one's claims to importance, and this applies to everyone, whether it's the artist, the curator, the gallerist, the museum director, the board member, the museum architect, the collector, the patron, publishers, editors, writers, teachers. Each class of participant is going to use whatever resources it has to garner as much recognition as possible, which will invariably be at somebody else's expense, working across the sort of permeable membranes that separate these different roles or categories of participant from each other. And the sum of those interactions will, I'm suggesting, constitute the current shape of the art world, but something which is always changing based on the fact that those relationships or balances will be in a continual flux. Now, I want to, for the purposes of this talk, not try to talk about that whole ball of wax, but just to concentrate on one case of this sort of co-evolution. The mid to later 1950s saw the first real embrace of contemporary art by museums as institutions, seems to me. And one of the first artists to be singled out for this treatment was one who also kicked against it right from the start. If we have left, right, please. I'm going to have to call out the slide changes. Mark Rothko was very fond of a remark made by Paul Valéry, who said that to walk into a museum was like listening to six orchestras all playing at the same time. And I'm showing you a Rothko in its hang at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art as just one of many instances of Rothko's particular nightmare. From the first moment that his work began to be seen in group shows, he longed to see it inhabit a space in which there were no other conductors present. His initial efforts to realize that ambition, the Tate-Seeger murals being one important instance of this, attracted two patrons, the next on the left, please, who were prepared to make this a thoroughgoing reality. Jean and Dominique de Menil commissioned him in 1964 to be the sole artist represented on the interior walls of a college chapel in Houston that they were commissioning, the design of which they'd already entrusted to Philip Johnson, no less. Now, next on the right, in order for Rothko both to visualize and execute a commission on this scale, the Menils financed a new studio for him, an old carriage house on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, where he was able to build a real size mock-up of the chapel interior, and you see that going up in the form of these stud walls in the photograph on the right with Rothko present. Left, right, please. Over some 4 years, between 1964 and 1968, he went through a painstaking process of painting, repainting, constant adjustments and revisions. He never saw the final institution of the canvases in Houston, as his death came in 1970 before the paintings were put into place. This was the chapel for him. But he'd managed in the meantime to make the actual destination of the paintings at a distance, down there in Houston, as much like the architecture of his studio as he possibly could have done. Can I have the next one on the left, please? This was Philip Johnson's initial design. Many of you will have seen it. Next on the right, please, and know that the final building looks like that. He got rid of Johnson altogether, eliminated the architect, and eliminated much of what you might call the architecture, specifying this austere brick octagon that we see today. The claims of the architectural container being drained to a minimum in favor of what lay inside. The Rothko Chapel became a building in which the facade, left, right, please, is expressed on its interior by means of the paintings it contains. And you see that they had to be lowered through the skylight, being too large to go through the very narrow and constraining entrance. Now, it's difficult to think about an older generation figure like Rothko, who is an absolutely unalloyed believer in the grandeur and emotional necessity of art, to think about him in the context of what's come to be called institutional critique. a mode of art practice identified by common consensus with early to mid-70s work by Hans Hacke, Michael Ascher, Marcel Bruders, Daniel Burin, other names could be adduced to. But to the extent that these works assume the museum's bricks and mortar to embody an antagonistic set of ideological beliefs, I think Rothko gave nothing away to these younger artists in his antipathy to customary museum architecture and curatorial practices. Next, left, right. And of course, he was doing it at exactly the same historical moment. As his example makes plain, too, the more weight that's put on the subtlety and intensity of perception in front of the work, which his canvases certainly do demand, the more its architectural container becomes an issue. The New York studio and the final destination of the pictures in the Houston Chapel both constituted a folding inward of the normal museum exterior pomp, drained away from the outside to the interior by the sheer enigmatic scale of the painting. Left, right, please. Now for a change of scene. Early in 1969, the year following Rothko's completion of the Houston paintings, the Canadian artists Ian and Ingrid Baxter, operating as the N.E. Thing Company, installed the work you see here, N.E. Thing Company Building Structure, a complete inhabitation of the Carmen Lamana Gallery in Toronto by a parasitical structure of 2x6 studs, which duplicated the invisible supporting structure behind the walls and squeezed the space of the gallery to a narrow interval between the open work volume and the existing wall of the gallery. Now, it should be clear, I am adding the Baxters to the pantheon of institutional critique artists I mentioned a few minutes ago. But I think in describing this piece, it might better be said that the sculpture reconstituted the architecture, which supplanted the deceptive skin of the gallery interior, rendering it useless for hanging or enclosing the usual sort of portable art objects. The Baxters were overtly, rather than tacitly, refusing the distinction between art object on the one hand and its container on the other. Their 1969 piece preceded by some months the first of Michael Ascher's major sequence of gallery site pieces, which have become a really recognized touchstone for the common understanding of institutional critique. Left, right, please. Take this iteration, and I'm showing you a very typical Ascher gallery announcement, and I thought it would be appropriate to this setting in that it was installed at the old Listen space in 1973. Ascher decided on an intervention in the space, which you, if you knew what you were looking for, could see on the right-hand side, but I expect those of you who don't already know the piece will miss it. Can we have the next on the left, please? What he did was carve out what he called an institutional reveal. This is a cross-section where you can see the gap between the wall and the floor, 1/4 inch high and 1.5 inches deep, would be cut all around the perimeter of the gallery. Can we have the left, right, please? Just another wall and a sort of close-up where you can see a little more of this shadowed gap or reveal. In Ascher's own words, quote, the vertical wall surfaces remained part of the architectural container while being visually isolated between floor and ceiling. The isolated floor plane could therefore be seen as analogous to the wall's pictorial plane. Now, the description goes on in such a way that I think it starts to qualify, I think, the usual understanding of institutional critique as being about some antagonistic unmasking of the institution and the wider supporting structures that are brought to bear to make the occasion for the exhibition or installation possible. As he wrote further, and I'll quote again, "The creation of a pictorial or sculptural sign traditionally involves the addition of materials to an initial support until some sort of resolution is brought about. The work at the Listen Gallery reversed this process by creating a sign or mark in which materials were withdrawn from the architectural support." Now, withdrawn, for me, plainly signifies a diminishing or hollowing out of the container within which the work of art would conventionally be enclosed. It's typical of Asher's production at this moment that he pushes the boundary of the work right up to and indeed through the walls of the gallery, which is what this piece does. It actually hollows out a bigger area of floor space, a bigger volume than the gallery, in fact, supplies to begin with. Left, right, please. And one could say much the same thing about a work he built at the Claire Copley Gallery in Los Angeles in the autumn of 1974, where he removed the normal partition wall that partially concealed the office and storage areas from the space of display. He also refinished the walls so as to remove any existing marks or imperfections that might have acted as independent objects of perception, the result being, in his words, a continuous, flawless container. Now, Asher has indulged himself in some rhetoric about this piece exposing the transformation of art into exchange commodity, and you know, it would seem to be about, hey, there's an office there. I mean, there's business going on. It's just not only the experience of the art. But that seems to me a relatively trivial way of looking at the piece. I think it's much more interesting to think about how he found a way for the work, that continuous, flawless container, to push itself out to the maximum margins that the entire gallery space allowed, with everything in its path being subsumed in the process. So I don't think that the right word is critique here so much as it is competition. Next on the right, there's a struggle going on for possession of the container. This is his isometric drawing of the Copley space, standing in for container here. The membrane of the exhibiting space, which can be shifted by this competition in either direction, that is, either towards the possession of the artist or back towards the property rights of the gallery or the museum. Now, there's the paradox that the revelation of this membrane as both permeable and shifting boundary seems to entail its remaining virtually invisible. Just as the reveal at the base of the Listen Gallery walls would have required a strongly prepared sensitivity and concentrated attention to have noticed it at all, even at the time. The Copley installation entailed the removal of anything that might unnecessarily catch the eye. So in this, I don't think we're a world away from Rothko and his chapel. Rothko was not undertaking a systematic critique of institutions. He just distrusted and feared them. His Houston paintings, in effect, drained the independent life from their container, as I've said, but in the process, they lost the contrasts and variety of striking images, left please, that had characterized his work up until that juncture. Right please. His canvases then became far more diffuse, harder to discern in original terms, as they together colonized the membrane and won it back from the possession of the interior envelope. And moving from the studio picture on the right, left please, to the installation photo, you can see the way in which the openings, the doors in the walls, are drawn into the triptych composition of the canvases. So, having posited a competitive dynamic set in play at the end of the 1960s between the container and its contents, it would certainly be surprising if it just stayed like that. I mean, if one state of play were preserved indefinitely. In fact, there's always going to be a pushback whenever one party gains an advantage over the other. Left, right, please. So, Renzo Piano and Richard Rogers, I think, almost instantly reacted to the conceptual destabilization of the museum during the early 1970s through a wide variety of process-oriented pieces and time-based pieces with their center for the Centre Pompidou. The most signal attribute of this multifaceted museum, which really set the standard for the new civic flagship philosophy of museum design, was that the normally hidden functions of the building, from its structural skeleton to its heating ducts and visitor circulation, were expressed on the outside of the building. Ian and Ingrid Baxter had brought the invisible supporting structure, the physical gallery, into view on the interior. The Vaubourg team did it on the outside. The museum stood exposed as a set of practical exigencies, its temple-like pretensions dissolved. The artists moved to deploy materials withdrawn from the architectural support, now faced a counter move by the museum architects to thicken and dramatize the envelope by reversing the direction of exactly the same procedure. But once again, there was an artist around shadowing this leap forward in museum design as if to say, not so fast. The creation of a new model civic monument, in this case, may indeed entail the dissolution of the museum's heavy symbolic legacy. But at the same time, its dissolution of the historical, social, and physical fabric that stood on this site was all too real, a hard and heavy job of work with painful trade-offs. Gordon Monteclark arrived in Paris in 1975 as the spidery Centre Pompidou skeleton was emerging amid the last demolitions to clear the 17th century quarter for the development of that whole new touristic and commercial precinct around it. He had been granted the use of two 17th century houses which were awaiting demolition, I mean really awaiting demolition. As soon as he was done with the piece, they went down, just to the north of the museum. He called them a nice pair of husband and wife houses because they had been jointly owned by a 17th century couple, part of the judicial nobility of the area. Let's have left, please. So we undertook to cut a single conical shape that would link the husband and wife houses together. This is his diagram of the sort of complex geometry that resulted from the cone going through the rectilinear structures of the houses. It carved at an upward angle through them, the large end canted downward, right please, facing the busy Rue Beaubourg, while the small end, left please, penetrated the roof of the second house, allowing a glimpse through this sort of reversed telescope effect of the updated Gothic tracery of the Centre Pompidou's exoskeleton. Right, please. His conception came consciously from a 1971 film installation piece by Alan McCall, line inscribing a cone, where the image on the screen consists of a white point on a black ground slowly growing to inscribe a complete circle, while at the same time a fog machine in the room turns the passage of the light from projector to screen into a palpable shape like a piece of sculpture. Monteclark called his Paris project Conical Intersect and effectively turned inside out the uncanny effective presence that McCall had achieved in line inscribing a cone, where McCall made the immaterial cone of vision into something one could seemingly observe and touch. Monteclark enlarged and transformed it into an invisible, impalpable projectile capable of eating away at the most solid historical matter. Next on the right, please. he pitched the spectator back inside the monocular cyclopean projection, there to reveal the unexpected patterns of a fully cubist complexity torn from the architectural fabric by the crossover between the two geometries. In the process, he restaged the triumph of the Pompidou over the historic city, on whose weight and bulk it imposed a dream of weightless architecture. Conical Intersect bit the dust, as I said, virtually the moment it was completed, but during its brief life, it succeeded in reducing the new modern museum to a nearly invisible prospect, as if seen through a telescope from the wrong end. The view back on what was being lost had far more vividness. Mata Clark's cone brought Piano's and Rogers' edifice back to earth, affected through the artist's own physical labor and physical endurance. Before his death in 1978, Mata Clark returned to Paris to execute a more modest piece that pushed the gallery envelope downwards along its vertical axis. The site was, left, right, please, was the basement of, that's the order I wanted it in. You'll see the basement of the Yvon Lambert Gallery in a minute. The title of the piece is called Descending Steps for Baton, its dedication being to his late twin brother, Sebastian, who was nicknamed Baton in the family. In both of these pictures, the boys, as they grew up with their mother. In between, Gordon is on the left in both of them, and Baton on the right. Baton had taken his own life in Gordon's own studio under the most horrific circumstances just a few months before. Now, left, right, we'll see some evidence of the piece itself. Its execution entailed the artist digging into the earthen basement floor, which for the visitors to the gallery was visible through an opening cut into the floor, which you see on the left, and you'd look down and see Mata Clark digging away, his work illuminated by a dangling trouble lamp, continuing to excavate as long as the show lasted, leaving as he dug a sequence of shallow steps down into the dirt. Next on the left, please, and a view down in the cave of the gallery itself. Now, these interventions of Mata Clark's were certainly short-lived and little noticed in the wider world, but they did attract the attention of one architect in particular. Frank Gehry, already in the mid-1970s, was seeking out examples of Mata Clark's work for his own collection. And it's easy to see the reinforcement that Gehry found there for his own developing aesthetic of odd cuts and angles in the most ordinary building materials, one that found its expression finally in museum design, left, right, please, through his transformation of an existing industrial structure into the temporary contemporary Museum of Art in Los Angeles, now the Geffen Contemporary, while a lesser architect's design was being executed as the main museum. But in this kind of rapid fire exchange, exterior and interior, obviously, of the now Geffen Contemporary, and in this rapid fire exchange, no sooner was Gehry's design in place than it attracted a counterstatement. Next on the right, please. This coming from Chris Burden in a piece called Exposing the Foundations of the Museum. The piece accomplished precisely what its title says, removing a subfloor and extending three excavations into the earth, each with a set of steps that allowed visitors to approach the point where the museum's lowest foundations actually touched the substratum, the non-built, foundation of the structure, that plane where the building positively and definitively went no further. left, please. You see Chris's drawings there on the right of, you know, over the photograph of the structure. But I think the piece also resembles the excavation of a ritual tomb. Descending steps for Batan echoes in it, as one remembers Burden's close friendship with Mata Clark, whose own sudden and unexpected death from cancer had come just 2 years after his brother's suicide. Surely propelled by this emotional impetus, Burden's piece ups the ante on the architect, exceeding the point beyond which the architect, constrained by considerations of utility and structural soundness, cannot go. But Geary's ultimate response, when he gained the opportunity that his home city had denied him, has become so familiar and emblematic that I'm almost embarrassed to bring it up. Left, right, please. The Guggenheim Bilbao. Did it require, one can ask, the Baroque efflorescence of building surface that we see here in order to outflank the likes of Mata Clark? The building is endlessly discussed for good reason, as even its antagonists acknowledge by their vehemence its success in regaining the upper hand for the architect, and by extension, his institutional patron in this distributional competition that I think constitutes our present system of art and transcends the claims of either competitor. Now, on the basis of the pattern established by the examples we've been looking at, one predictable way that artists might seek to recover their ascendancy against the container would be to press the work as hard up against the membrane as they possibly could, even seeking to surpass it. In the case of Guggenheim Bilbao, the membrane presents itself in the shape of Geary's famous undulating surfaces. And this was precisely the point where Andrea Fraser pressed her inbuilt artist's advantage of improvisation and surprise. She entered the museum, left please, as an ordinary visitor and proceeded to rent an audio guide, tracked by Confederates with hidden video cameras. As the male voice in a plummy English accent intones the script for visitors, and I really wish I could imitate it, but I wouldn't venture to do so. And this provides the soundtrack for the 6-minute video piece that she did. One hears the audio guide person speaking, the actor speaking, while Fraser proceeds in a series of actions to follow its instructions, that is, the guide's instructions. Right, please. It says, if you haven't done so already, walk away from the desk where you picked up this guide and out into the great high space of the atrium. Left. Isn't this a wonderful place? I'll skip ahead now to the passage where the voice guides the visitor to the interior surfaces of this space, right? As you look around, you'll see that every surface in this space curves. Left. These curves are gentle, but in their huge scale, powerfully sensual. You'll see people going up to the walls and stroking them, right? You may feel the desire to do so yourself. Go right up, left. Run your hand over them. Feel how smooth it is, right? Well, I could see, I was afraid a lot of people would have seen the video and this would all be rather redundant and stale, but it sounds like it's still pretty new. It's, of course, my rendition of it does no justice to the actual thing. And the track plays on much longer than I have time to continue quoting for as I said, the audio track for this 2001 video she entitled Little Frank and His Carp. Now, there are two scandals enacted in this piece, it seems to me, and I think the first is the milder one, in that Fraser's character in the video obviously overdoes the instructions, but not in a way that in fact betrays their literal significance. Even so, even having done this, she reports that none of the ubiquitous guards in the museum intervened to stop it. But where they had to be much more careful, and this constitutes the second, I think, larger scandal, was in the simple procedure of recording the event on tape, thereby violating the strict prohibition against visitors creating their own record and their own fixed memories of what they've seen. Touching is permitted, encouraged even. The old decorum of the museum has been superseded by a welcoming, informal ingratiation, but its image seems to be held in ever more strict control. So Fraser went to work on the image, supplanting it with one of her own, using the museum's own account of itself as a found object, including its embrace of the cliché term seductive as a way of describing Geary's newer architecture, and applying some tested conceptual art jujitsu in order to make the institution speak differently. She succeeds by adhering as closely as possible to the limits of the container, and once again finding a way to assemble materials that have been withdrawn from the architectural support. And in one strong sense, they stay withdrawn. I mean, I count myself, I have to say, an admirer of the building. But as in any effective form of mockery, its object will be permanently reduced, subtracted from, in the minds of most people who've seen the video. So Fraser's path represents the tested one, whereby an artist might overcome the competitive advantage achieved by Geary, along with the whole current wave of assertive museum architecture. Right, please. Richard Serra's direct response to Bilbao, needless to say, offers a diametrically opposed challenge to the competitive ascendancy of the museum. His approach being to impose as much stationary weight and substance at the core of Geary's space. And while Fraser situates her surreptitious contribution to the Bilbao Museum at its skin, at the plane of contact between that skin, which is a metaphor after all, with her real skin, her real epidermis comes into play, Serra, in fact, in his rhetoric surrounding his recent installation, which we'll see in just a minute, registers a marked aversion even to the concept of skin. He tells Hal Foster in a recent interview that he regards the skin of the building with aversion. Next on the left, please. One of the big problems in contemporary architecture, he says, is the division between the structure, the more engineered part, and the skin, the more architected part. Many architects now focus a little on the layout and a lot on the ornament, whether it's glass, titanium that bends, the scenographic surface ornament as skin, end of quote. Well, I can't think who he might be talking about. The occasion for the interview, of course, is Serra's monumental installation. Left and right, please. 8 massive pieces in the largest gallery in the Bilbao Museum. 7 new pieces in the so-called Fish Gallery, and you see a wall label diagram of the layout of the pieces on the left, and one view from the upper mezzanine down on the installation. All these photographs had to be done quite as surreptitiously as Fraser's video, in fact, and they didn't come out too badly, even though my camera was being sort of tucked away, under my coat, most of the time that I was walking around. The expanded installation, as you know, will be as permanent as these things get. It's contracted to be there for 25 years. But for all that, you know, close complementarity between the existence of the museum and the fact of this commission, the quotation that I just read you is as close as either Foster or Sarah come to mentioning Geary's name in their whole published conversation. And that aversion, I think, is writ large in the installation. As the sculptures pull back from the skin of the building, settling with self-evident mass in order to assert their own autonomous pockets of space. Left, right, please. Now, while Sarah has, of course, been working for quite a long time on the nested ellipses and spirals that constitute the bulk of the Bilbao installation, but I think it's telling in the context, and I show you an outer view and an inner one on the right, it's telling that the viewer's experience of every piece entails having the surrounding space hidden by the high walls and the labyrinthine paths that enclose the view and shut out everything else. It's an effect of captivity, of ensuring that at key points the museum enclosure simply can't be seen. One reaches the center of a piece, as on the right, with the strong sense of having found refuge in a kind of forest clearing. Now, I don't think this is far-fetched as a way of talking about Sarah. Left, please. Because one of his great early triumphs, spin-out for Bob Smithson at the Kohler-Müller Museum, relies for its moving effect on the viewer's actual entry into a sheltering woodland hollow. And the persistence of that strain of nature poetry in Sarah's work was underlined for me when I encountered the first glowing review of the torqued ellipses back around 99-2000 in the pages left-right of a surfing magazine. And I won't be the one to say that the writer there failed to understand him. The nature of Sarah's protest is romantic at heart. Its insistence on the oneness of material and form goes hand in hand with an implicit fusion of authenticity of art with authenticity of self. Right, please? But just consider the sheer scale of the physical apparatus that this aesthetic seems now to require. It's doubtful that there is any artist currently working anywhere who could marshal the resources to mount this sort of challenge to the museum. Now, undeniably compelling and absorbing as they are as sculpture, Sarah achieving a consummate integration of his delicately controlled velocity of curving surfaces with the impression on the viewer of raw, overwhelming mass. But at the same time, his commanding autonomy, desire for a commanding autonomy of these pieces, tends to evaporate the moment one looks up. Left, please. Then the trajectory of Sarah's curves refused to remain disconnected to all the cognate forms in the swooping, soaring beams and walls in Geary's enclosure. The two of them, sculptor and architect, have for years been engaged in a half-acknowledged dialogue. The physical fruit of that exchange is evident in Bilbao, and it does extract Sarah from the romantic individualism of his stated intentions. Left, right, please. The result is a symphonic harmony and counterpoint of sculpture with architecture that I think, for purposes of comparison, probably requires reaching back to genuine Baroque examples. Now, this takes nothing away from either of them. But it does make Sarah's go-it-alone rhetoric harder to credit as adequate to his own contribution. The museum as concept and institution isn't going to get pushed any further by his attempt to match its scale and splendor on its own terms. Those doing the pushing, those who will win space for art against the museum and force the museum to respond, will go on, I suspect, working away at the margins in comparative invisibility. Left, please. Our Freeze poster child of the month, Maurizio Catalan's little stand-in, coming through the floor of the gallery, I think, turns to comic effect this strategy of subtraction, continual push and pull between artist and institution over possession of the thin membrane that separates aesthetic from mundane space. So, thank you very much for your attention. So we are doing questions, and there are two microphones. We have assistants here holding, and it would be good if you can just be patient enough to start your question when you receive the microphone, if there are any.
Since we had Stockhausen yesterday here and following the brilliant logic of this competition, what would you say if you know, Basque, if that museum would be blown up by terrorism?
Well, that kind of exceeds the framework of my analysis, I have to say. They're obviously doing their best to make sure that that doesn't happen. I mean, the security presence is enormous there, and probably the visible part of it is just a fraction of what's in fact at work. The history of this, you know, transnational collaboration in the context of Spanish nationalism and Basque separatism is a rich subject, no doubt. I only say it is devoutly to be wished that such an event does not take place. It's you know, people love this place. You just have to go on any summer day, even gray, rainy ones, to see that. And you know, it would be the most heinous crime, I think, for anyone to put the visitors of this museum in any kind of jeopardy. So I would just like to table that issue. There's one of the first questions was down there.
I would just be interested if you maybe very short could comment or elaborate on the competitive dynamics between the artist, the art critic, and the curator, that debate on power positions and about the competition between maybe mainly the art critic and the curator.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I would kind of separate the two terms you've joined together in your first, the first sentence of your question. That yes, there's competition, and there is, just a tendency for people to enlarge their space of recognition. But joining it to power, I think, shifts it into another descriptive vocabulary, which has been around and very well used for a long time, just in this common sense signification of the word, in a sort of Foucault kind of transmutation of it. And I think that is distorting, you know. I mean, that is to say, an advantage might be construed as a greater power, but that entails connotations of a kind of drive for dominance or aggression that I think is not always the case, or not even usually the case. Systems don't work like that. You know, the desire to expand one's sphere probably should be less emotionalized, I think, than that term suggests. Success in expanding one's sphere is usually the result of having done something effective, you know, of having extracted something from the architecture, say, or for a critic, for example, to have formulated something, and this has happened a lot, you know, that practicing artists haven't quite, you know, pulled together. And it provides a kind of map or direction that artists are able to use. That goes on, but that's just what the critics do. I mean, they would cease to be critics if they weren't pushing as hard as they could against their membrane or their envelope. But, you know, artists will get touchy and feel that their prerogatives are being, you know, a little bit encroached upon, and they will find ways to respond. And this is going on across the board. So if we even at a minimum posit, say, a dozen different categories of actor within the art world, you start just calculating the exponential combinations that will result in, and we see we're dealing with an incredibly complex system that has to be simplified and modeled if we're going to understand it at all. So that's what I was kind of trying to do today. Yes, Mark.
Yeah, it's more just of a comment than a question. I'm just very, very interested in the way you mapped out the dialogue between artists and architects. And it's my perception that it seems that a lot of artists have kind of given up the game of that dialogue, but have turned towards modernist architecture as a kind of source for remakes and reimagining modernist buildings. I'm thinking of projects like one that Pierre Huyghe made, Rick Richter of Venetia, Simon Starling and Sam Durant, especially around Le Corbusier and Schindler in LA. And it seems that this kind of marks, I think, in some way a new dialogue, not with new buildings that are being built now, but with older ones.
But do you think there might be an element of a sort of evasion involved, that is, seeing a current problem and then finding an imaginary retrospective one in order to make art out of?
Yeah, that's what I think kind of motivates, you know, obviously each project's different, but as a kind of trend or of, you know, sequence of works, I think, yeah, that is kind of one way of thinking about it, that they're evading, or that's the way they're pursuing the problem of logo architecture and spectacular.
Yeah, but it's a way into the problem. I don't mean to imply by that counter question that I think it's, you know, compromised in some way. I mean, it is a way of understanding, particularly in Los Angeles, which is the place I know best, a peculiar local tradition in which artists have always felt very much connected. I mean, more connected to the traditions of Amy Gray modernism in Los Angeles than is probably the case in most other art communities, I'd guess. Then Martha has a question.
I wonder why we should be satisfied with an analysis that says that we needn't look outside the intentionality of the actors. If you're doing a kind of system analysis, which seems to be something that you're after, it seems to me that all of this takes place within a larger system in which the meaning of these moves is being foreclosed by your saying, oh, well, everybody just wants a larger piece of the pie, which is the specular economy, if you will, or attention of whatever form. And I find that profoundly unsatisfying, even if it is only a step on the way to analysis of what is the inbuilt meaning of the contest of artist enunciations against architectural enunciations and choices of artists over architecture or vice versa by the communities that have the financial ability to make those choices.
Well, I'm certainly not ruling out the next wider sphere of description of what's going on. you know, there is an asymmetry to the system. It struck me that you could turn it into a kind of formula that as money crosses the boundary in the hands of collectors and patrons, it's translated into attention or validation. As artists achieve attention and validation, they're able to cross the boundary in the other direction and turn it into money or turn it into other kinds of, let's say, not artistically specific sorts of outcomes. But once you've posited that next ring or that next sphere, it is itself subject, to the extent that one can do it, to the same sort of analysis that should happen on the inside. And it brings with it, you know, ever more charged questions of political choice and ethical, you know, urgencies. But I guess what I'm counseling against is I try to sort of groping in this direction. Is, you know, having grown up with the ethical choices having been immediately imported into the internal sphere of the art making and everything colored by that, whether we haven't foreclosed a simple act of understanding of what's going on, you know, of effective kind of model building so that we can grasp, you know, what's taking place with sufficient rigor so that, you know, the next phase of reintroducing ethical considerations into the making of art can be more sophisticated than, you know, the first wave of it. It's not to take anything away from that, but everything, you know, has its useful life. And historicization of institutional critique, I think, which is all around us. You know, the minute something gets talked about everywhere, then, you know, it's over. And what it was about in the first place, which I was, you know, advocating in every way I could, my, you know, at the time, from my own, you know, sort of marginal position, I think has to be reconfigured and reinvented, and I'm not quite sure that anybody's got a good idea, you know, how to do it with commensurable force to the first time around. So to get away from retrospection, nostalgia, sense of decay, you know, the 60s and 70s nostalgia you hear everywhere, which I think we can't afford for very much longer. So this is just my effort to try to kind of clear a path for, you know, what might ensue, you know, that would be commensurable with that phase of art, which I obviously so much admire and write about all the time. There was a question back there. I don't know whether the person's given up. Oh, okay, there you are.
I think you've actually partially answered, but maybe I'll ask again, just because I'm still not fully satisfied. I really like the way you've substituted competition for critique, but I wonder if you haven't slightly depoliticized some of the artists we normally think of as institutional critique. And I also still feel like there's quite a lot of slippage between a competition that's aesthetic and formal, a competition that is ego-individual, and a competition that is more sociological and political. So I was wondering if you could...
Yeah, well, I think there's a whole lot of things, as I hear you, you know, nested in that question. I mean, the first thing you said about the aesthetic and formal, you know, they're just about all the artist has to work with. I mean, the artist has moral authority and very slender material means vis-a-vis the resources that the envelope commands, or those who build, maintain, expand, etc., the envelope. One of the things I'm also trying to do, which I hope is a help to the legacy that I do, you know, admire and want to keep at the forefront of people's understanding of recent art is to get out of that trap which every middle of the road, you know, critic or writer is ready to spring. You know, you're deconstructing the institution, but you're dependent on the institution. So you're in this hypocritical, you know, double bind. And actually, Andrea Fraser talks about that very effectively in the essay that appeared in the last Art Forum but one, I thought. And I think takes the whole issue and describes her own, in fact, part that she played in the kind of unfolding of institutional critique as a term, which is a sort of second or third generation redescription of something from, you know, that was not called that or embraced by the people who had made it in the first place. And she's very good on that. And I think she gets to a very sound conclusion, except that I missed a dynamic principle at work in the way that she, you know, asks that we recognize mutual interdependence, but without something, you know, with some force to it, which I'm calling competition, I don't see how we can use it as a model for change.
Hi, that was I thought a really amazing paper, and it's very put together lots of provocative things. I really enjoyed the stuff about Rothko in particular. But I just want to focus on the ending. I think you arrived at a wonderful reading of Sarah by the end. I'm not so sure about Catalan, particularly given his presence within this fair and the way in which I think he's in competition, not just in museums, but with curators doing the next year's Berlin Biennial, with newspapers, with other
dealers,
commercial galleries.
Yeah, he's opened Gagosian Berlin.
Yeah. I mean, what you're dealing with Catalan is someone who's competing with every other player in the game, and there's something slightly obscene about that.
Well, probably true, and I, you know, I wasn't trying to present myself as a sort of Catalanist or something. I just thought I needed a way to end the paper, and I actually chose this back home before I saw the current issue of Frieze, so it was a kind of coincidence. But I, in fact, I, you know, Catalan is still a bit of a mystery to me. I'm kind of catching up with the guy, and you know, I'm sure that it's going to be, art history and sort of the art established academic series, art critical circles, are not good on trickster figures. They were never good on Warhol for ages and ages. They've got no grasp on Koons, McCarthy. Now there's Catalan. But these are, you know, the artists who've had arguably the greatest, you know, measurable impact. So on you know, their the artists internationally that came after them. So I'm not sure that what I'm proposing is going to be a way to corral those figures, but it's certainly a, you know, an incomplete project. And they always induce this kind of moral queasiness in people. It seems to be a pretty repeated pattern. But, you know, if Catalan is competing with everybody and in every direction, which I assume and gather that he is, he's going to compete in an area that coincided with what I was talking about. So I had this little cartoon image that I could end the paper with. Yes, Martha, again.
I can't resist just sharing my discomfort with the idea of starting with an artist who's at the edge, the end of a moment in which the artist is trying to present a vision of a look into transcendence and trying to best the container and say, no, but transcendence is an inner condition. See, I'm reading not tactical things, but kind of more strategic things to somebody who's saying, well, look, this is a commercial system, and what's at question here is where do we focus? Do we look at the way in which the flow of capital co-opts the message or presents
the message? So who is saying that? Who's your Second example?
I guess that would be people who cut little pieces out of... yes, and then moving on to, well, then looking at the Beaubourg as a kind of, you know, a gigantic engine of capital. It's not that I'm so intent on looking at precisely what system each artist is confronting, but the idea that in this war of all against all, we're focusing on the players within a subsystem rather than on the systems that they're facing. For example, I think much more important now than looking at the commercial flow in a gallery would be the way in which communities choose architecture as their works of art, and how both artists and architects may be fighting for dominance against mass culture and the culture of spectacle, and that somehow these concerns dwarf the issue of whether Catalan is or is not coming out of the base of every single gallery in the universe. So I'm just expressing disquiet over a focus that narrows down so much to this, you know, constant competition for who's in front of the camera, when in fact the entire studio is being obscured.
The entire...
The signing in which this battle of players is occurring.
Yeah, I mean, again, battle, it starts, takes you back to a sort of late 19th century social Darwinism or something, or a Hobbesian, which what I'm saying, I'm not saying that what I'm positing is benign, you know, or simply a procedural matter. But it also is a vehicle, or indeed the only vehicle, where much of what we regard as the positive rewards of making art, being interested in art, in here, you know. I mean, you can't, what I'm saying is you can't separate them. If you try to separate them out, the whole thing just falls to pieces, or just becomes a sort of frozen, polemical, undynamical description of something which is constantly changing and shifting. And it's finding a way to understand change, which, even though I am among the category of person who calls myself an art historian, and history is supposed to be about change, we seem to be least able to talk about that as an object of scrutiny, which is what I was trying to do, you know, in this kind of hypothetical model making. Okay, I've got, Jakob's got the 5-minute sign up there, so we have time for a few more questions.
Yeah, the question of institutional critique I would like to take up again. I mean, in that this Andrea Fraser article, I thought was quite totalizing and kind of reductive, in the sense that she said, okay, everybody, every player, even the visitor, is implicit in this kind of system. Therefore, it doesn't really make sense anymore to even take this kind of logic up. But I think there are degrees we should not forget of implicity and like being complicit in turning things around. And I just thought that what's interesting, particularly with that generation, and particularly then currently what you see here on displays, is this kind of nostalgia of conceptual art, where people just parodying all these conceptual art pieces, is that basically institutional critique becomes institutional narcissism. I mean, also something you addressed here.
Well, that would be the danger. That would be another way of describing the danger as, you know, what was that old book, Revolt into Style? And not that you can't make good art out of it, or that style is unimportant, because distinction in form and mode of address and so on is what artists are supposed to be professionally good at. And we don't have a lot of other people who have those skills. So one of the things about this compartmentalization model, or sort of membrane subroutine kind of model I was trying to describe, is that each one is a kind of crucial bearer of certain, you know, skills and practices and traditions which we'd all be the poorer without. And that may be the case with even some of the people who seem to be the instruments for inserting, you know, some of the really awful things about global capitalism into this world. But as they insert into it, they also have to enter into it. And they have to give something up of what they've brought. And that's not to explain, you know, the way these people made their money away or their pretensions and, you know, probably benighted social attitudes they carry around with them. But we're not talking about people who are bringing their whole persons in. They're only, you know, certain things are allowed and actually certain things will be disallowed. And everything is a kind of filtering. It lets in a lot of the bad as well, though, insofar as things that we might find very, you know, worthy of condemnation may find some purchase in the art system. So, say, Akunz, for example, is able to use a rhetoric of you know, I would even use the word complicity, as something which has had purchase in the art world, which we didn't think would work, and then it did. So let me just say, you know, instead of saying, well, just it can't work or it shouldn't work, we're not going to talk about that, we have to try to figure out why it did work, you know, and see what that says about everything else that makes us feel better about ourselves. You know, the stuff that doesn't make us feel so good about ourselves, I think, has to have kind of equal time. Okay, well, thank you all very much and for some really good questions.